All right. All right, so that was the First Crusade, basically. What was really being found out by the Westerners a lot was that the Byzantines had really lost their own will to survive, at least the people in the court. And the West really couldn't sustain numbers out there in the Holy Land for long. What you have here, represented by this white part now, was what came to be known as the Crusader Kingdoms or the Crusader Kingdom. Let's just call kingdoms plural. Each of these cities, Tyre, Antioch, Jerusalem, recaptured by Christians populating, but really the West couldn't, and this is, the West should not, here's one thing the West should not have done strategically, they should not have done this until, and it's, sure, they didn't understand the East was going to be a bunch of, but they should have learned after the first time the East is not in this. They're not going to really support it. They don't really have the ability to. They don't have the moral authority to. They don't have the intellectual storehouse to really justify doing this. And so if we're going to do this, we have to do it. We have to put funds and stuff to a permanent settlement there. They didn't do that, and that's why they had the one reason why they had to keep coming back. So they should have learned that. Godfrey of Bouillon, yeah, he remained with his family and he established a feudalistic economy there. That's what they were used to, the Franks, and so that's what they did there. But life there had to be, they didn't have as fertile a field, so they had to resort to urban work, and that's pretty much what they did. But they had to support it by a crusader tax back in the West, and that starts to build, and that starts to breed resentment by the time you get to the third, fourth, and fifth one, and it becomes the cause of its downfall. And there was never a ceasefire that was declared between Muslims and the West in the First Crusade. Fortified Muslim outposts throughout the region continued to slay pilgrims continuously. There was never a stop to that. 300 were slaughtered in one day on Easter in 1119, which prompted a group of French knights to propose a monastic order specifically designed to defend Christian pilgrims, and it became known as the Knights Templar. Conspiracy time! No, there's nothing conspiratorial about it. It was just a monastic group that were A, knights, and B, now monks. And they were called knights because they were all knights. Anyone who was accepted without a background in that kind of lifestyle was quickly and rigorously trained. And they were housed in what was called Solomon's Temple. So this is where that second word comes from, Templar. They obtained the support of one of the great theologians of the day, a guy named Bernard of Clairvaux. His dates are 1090 to 1153. He's really a major player throughout the 12th century, the best theologian of the age before Aquinas, and with a lot of moral authority, which we'll see why in just a little bit. Bernard himself was trained as a knight, so he had carefully considered the doctrine of just war. And that was not a new idea, as these historians. Augustine, Ambrose had already drawn that up as early as the 5th century. And so this idea of a just war was not invented by Bernard or the Pope at that time or anything else, or as a reaction to reinterpret the Crusades or anything like that. He drew up rules for the order, the Knights Templar, and requested a council at Troyes for its universal acceptance. And with the crusading fervor, and because it was easy to donate money, or easier to donate money than to risk one's own life, giving to the Templars' order became fashionable, and so the order became among the richest in Europe, not just among the richest of monasteries, but the richest institutions of all. Of course, if you were a rich monastery at the time, you were one of the richest institutions, because remember I made the point that in France, in the century before, the church had owned, I think, two-thirds, well, at least one-third of the land, of all the land in France. And so monasteries were in the landlord business, and these guys in particular started to get a lot of donations because it centered on the crusade. It was people's way to give at that time. It was the easiest, and remember, there's merit. This is a form of penitence going on here. And so this is a lucrative industry right from the beginning, this monastic order. And the problem is they had to station a lot of people in Europe to handle these finances, which sort of defeated the purpose of being a force in the Holy Land, since it required massive amounts of servants and protectors back on the continent to manage the bulk of the estates that would begin to accumulate. In fact, nobody moved more money around Europe than the Templars, such that they became effective banks, lending money at interest rates as high as 33% to 50%. So, if you're worried about the mortgage crisis today, they're a little bit worse than. Even the English king, John, esteemed their institution enough to store all of his precious jewels within their London vault in 1204, which wasn't good for them because they would be attacked on that basis as well and accused of many things. But so they weren't as powerful. By the way, as you see at the end of the Crusade, they were one of the groups that were persecuted a lot as well. So the Templars were not this powerful. They were powerful in their money and their money handling, but they weren't the... I didn't watch the stupid Da Vinci Code because I recognize I see stupid when I see it, and I don't watch it. But were the Templars, were that part of I don't know. They were there. Tom Hanks was there, so that's all that matters. Let's get back to Bernard for a second here. Bernard of Clairvaux. He's actually a good example of how it's not really easy to judge everybody in retrospect. His preaching and his piety were so exemplary that even Luther and Calvin would hold them in high esteem. You see Bernard quoted a bunch in the Institutes, for example. So perhaps he lacked the foresight to see where all the winds were blowing in justifying the Crusades as he did, being used by the Pope as he did to drum up support, to preach sermons, to preach taking up the cross. But his theology should be judged on its own merits, not on how others used it. Bernard joined in with the Cisterns, another group that we didn't get a chance to mention last time, the Cisterns, which were the most radical new monastic movement following those Cluniac reforms in the 10th century. They just took the Benedictine rule, but really hardcore. Like, they didn't eat anything except they had a juicer. They were like the people today that are like gunning off of meat and stuff like that. That was them at the time, except they were even more hardcore than that. It was Bernard's zeal and vision that spread their movement to his own monastery in Clairvaux. That's how he got the name Bernard of Clairvaux. That was the place he became the abbot, so to speak. And he preferred to stay there rather than take a lot of prestigious positions that were offered to him. That's another reason he gets a lot of respect. This guy could have been made the Pope as much. I mean, he taught the Pope theology. That was the kind of... He was like the R.C. Sproul of his day. All right? And so he could have been made Pope. He could have been made any number of things. Head of a university. But he so believed in the monastic life. And so his moral authority and his credit throughout Europe... I mean, whatever he said, if he preached on the Crusades, people went. If he would have preached condemning them, people would have been against them a lot sooner and in droves. So, and he was actually instrumental in healing an earlier papal schism. There's a big papal schism coming up in the 14th century, but there was an initial one that occurred between 1130 and 1138 when Innocent II, love that name. I mean, you got to stay away from that. Just in case something bad happens, like with your name signed on it, you really shouldn't take the name Innocent or Pious. You ever hear that one? Pious, you might as well, Pompous the First. I mean, Presumptuous II. I mean, you really shouldn't take those names just in case things go wrong. He was one of the popes, and then Anacletus II both made the claim at the same time. And Bernard was helpful in negotiating that and getting them back together. Subsequent crusades. In 1144, Muslim forces sought revenge by going around east through Edessa. So, where's that pink color again? Because this is going to symbolize... The Muslim so now they're going to come around this way to Edessa, this desert town northeast of the Holy Land. The really Nestorianism, when it pushed east, that was one of their headquarters. But the Muslims, of course, already took that. They're just retaking it in 1144. The city was captured successfully on Christmas Eve, 1144. Those who were not killed were sold into slavery. Now, Edessa was retaken by Crusaders in 1146. But then it was just as quickly taken back by Muslims in the same year. So the Second Crusade was now declared back in Europe by both French and German monarchs. Pope Eugene III had called for a new crusade the year before, but his voice carried no moral authority whatsoever. So what did they do? They got Bernard. The authoritative Bernard was called upon again, and he preached the crusade to enthusiastic crowds from France to Germany, and his servants... they took wooden crosses with them to hear him preach, so that whenever he did preach, his respondents could immediately sew these insignias onto their knight's clothing. That's how quickly the force of his talk really caught on with them, that kind of enthusiasm. And the Second Crusade, and really the rest of it, well, not the rest of it, but the Second Crusade especially plays out like the original Star Wars trilogy. The Empire struck back here with a vengeance, namely the Muslims. Smaller armies from the West transferred from Europe to Arabia. And that seems strange because now they were state-sponsored armies leaving the continent on Easter of 1147. Sort of. They were actually weighed down by tag-along pilgrims, and the Germans, just like they had done the first time, I didn't mention this, but this is one of the things they bring up, the Germans persecuted Jews along the way. I mean, you read this and you think, you know, the Germans are coming for this, but they see a Jew and they can't help themselves. That's kind of the idea that you're given. And that may have been the case. I'm not personally aware with how the Saxons first became more anti-Semitic than other people, if that's even true. I can tell you that Jews were treated very well in Central Europe prior to the 20th century. They were treated better there than they were in Russia and in other parts of the West. So I personally am not, I've never studied that in that great detail, but I don't think it is because the Orthodoxy was particularly strong in Central Europe versus other places. Those are the kind of suggestions that are often pushed on you, or maybe it's just something in German's blood. I don't think that's what the historians want to suggest. But it is suggested, something is being suggested there. But it is true that there were many persecutions of Jews along the way. Not everybody arrived in Constantinople until September of that year, 1147. But when they got there, they realized that the East, while they were gone, had signed a peace treaty with the Muslims. And not like the kind of peace treaty like I give, but backroom deal kind of a thing, furthering Europe's suspicions that the Orthodox mind was inferior when it came to where the world was going. They would take the same route south, the West would, and the Germans especially were ambushed at that time, possibly, a lot of historians think, set up by the Eastern court. In other words, saying, oh no, go that same route, you'll be fine, and by the way, we'll pledge supplies and soldiers, you know, just like we didn't do the first time. And so they did it, and they were ambushed by Muslim forces. Inflicting violence and completing their own pilgrimage to Jerusalem was all that was accomplished, and they simply left when they were ambushed at sea by the Byzantium navy. So, they went down here again, ambushed, comes to nothing, a little bit of a dinky peace treaty, they start to leave with their tail between their legs, and the East's naval fleet ambushes them. You would think that by this time they would say, okay, they're pretty much Muslims at this point. We might as well kill them too, if we're killing people. But they didn't. Okay, so what all else is going on at this time? Because this is a thankless, regrettable project. But from a public relations standpoint, the Muslim centers of power saw it as a repelling of Europe's full power. Saladin, the Sultan of Egypt, retook most of the Crusader kingdom in 1187. So let's erase this color and put pink back in there. Now, there's these outposts here and there that have Christian populations, but they're being treated less and less liberally as these events unfold. And I would remind you again that the Muslims that are doing battle, this is going to come back, I'm going to keep teasing you on this, but the Muslims that are doing battle with the West in all of these groups are the ones up here who would be called the Turkish. And by the way, a lot of these people come from the Far East and Persian lands originally. Okay? These are not Arabs. That's going to be important. Hold on to that fact. Sorry, I don't want to tease you. The reason that's important is because Arabs in the Muslim world did not give a rip about the Crusades until the 20th century when liberal, self-hating Westerners told them that they should. It was not something that they cared about in their history. They would rather have the Franks come in here than those accursed Turks. They didn't care until their elites started to study at Western universities where a bunch of Marxist, self-hating Westerners told them that, you know, the colonization going on right now in the 20th century, that's a lot like what we've been doing to you for years. You've been doing what? Yes, we've been imperializing and raping your women and all these different things. Man, that's news to us. We just thought the Turks were a bunch of bums. But that's a great idea. Thanks, liberal, self-hating Westerner. You've given us a new reason to have... That's literally what happened. That's a fact. So I won't tease anymore. That's why it matters. So all of this, and there's an appeal for a third crusade that begins all over Europe pretty much immediately. Richard the Lionhearted, that's a name. Now, like his sister, William of the Wench, or some of the other names, that we talked about. Richard the Lionhearted of England. He would have led the charge, but there was a dispute over land between the English and French, which made way for the German campaign on, Gibbons, 18th century. You know, you guys were fighting over a little theological dispute and you allowed the Arabs to come in. This is the same Gibbons that doesn't think that that's a good idea to defend that anyway, so hypocrite. But let's just leave that hypocrisy aside. Why didn't he complain about the English and the French, secular states bumping heads at this point? You know, you wouldn't have let Frederick of Barbarossa go over there alone if you English and French weren't fighting over this land. You don't hear those complaints because it's a secular state and not a religious institution. Anyway, I'd like to point out mindless hypocrisy every chance I get. But there was a dispute between the English and French, and because of that, they were hung up there, and the Germans really led the charge. Again, persecuting Jews as they went. Why is that pink? No, I don't want to make that pink, because the pink was the Muslim color. So the Germans, led by this guy Frederick, was their emperor, march east again. But again, they're getting the idea that Byzantium is going to come against them. This is on May 11th, 1189. He's taking that same route. But now Byzantium was in an official alliance with the Muslims. After armed resistance was met, the Germans made quick work of the Easterners and forced a new treaty of Adrianople in February of 1190. The campaign came to a very disappointing end. So, Germans come in here, the Eastern, they're going to just do what they do. All right, fine, we'll quickly wipe them out. They did. So the Germans have an imposing force. But then check this out. Right after they do that, they have this smashing victory. Frederick falls from his horse crossing a river and dies. And not only that, so his son leads the charge, but most of his soldiers were so devastated by that that they left. So this imposing army that crushes the East, coming down, they're ready to do this. The English and the French are going to join them. This is going to be like the biggest force ever. They can't fail this time. Guy falls off his horse. They're crying like girls, and they go home. Germans. Anyway, just in case there wasn't anybody else that I could offend effectively. But that's true. That's what happened. So the English and French do show up after they pretty much, their forces are depleted. There are German troops there, but they're minimized by this point. Richard brought the English. Philip Augustus brought the French, all by sea, with a vast navy from the Scandinavians as well. After making Saladin's navy ineffective for the rest of 1190, they arrived on land at the beginning of 1191 to join the Crusader siege of a town called Acre. I don't know. It's spelled like Acre, so I'm going with Acre. After the smashing victories in these first strikes, the French monarch went home to attend to domestic matters. Don't laugh. It's true. That's what happened. They were important. I don't know what they were, but I'm sure they were important. But it was now Richard commanding all of the European forces. Remember, Richard the Lionhearted, commanding all of the European forces against Saladin. On their way to Jerusalem, at a battle called Arsuf, the Crusaders were attacked. But again, superior cavalry made its point, and the Muslims had to withdraw for an entire year. But then with greater numbers a year later in 1192, he attacked again. So with no clear winner and plenty of exhaustion, the two struck a treaty that left Jerusalem unconquered, yet pledged safe pilgrimage to Christians to that city, which again was a mistake, but what are you going to do? There's not as much support from Europe. Nobody really has the incentive to have a permanent force there, so Christians are allowed there, but the Muslims pretty much still have this as their province. So those in Europe who saw glory far off in the Holy Land, but not the cost that it would take to permanently settle the area, demanded yet another crusade. Again, a blank check that you hand to your son and say, go over there, you might get killed, good luck with that. Are there more checks coming? I don't know. That's not the way you fight a war, but they were willing to do it. So there's this fourth crusade. But now there was just as much animus directed at Byzantium as against the Muslims. The West had been stabbed in the back and endangered by the very people who initially pled with them to send military support. So just as in the retreat of 1182, so now again in 1204, the Byzantine ships fired on the Western fleet. There was a sack of Constantinople that Western historians, again, they lament this just as much as we destroyed this unique culture, so we destroyed this unique culture right here. Again, I did that. I was there. You were there. If you believe in something that these guys believed, you were pretty much there. And why are they so bothered by this? These guys call themselves Orthodox. That's highly arrogant. Well, it's because there was a lot of Eastern art, and essentially because of how un-Western it was. the less Western you are, the more of a unique, wonderful culture that was destroyed when we showed up. That's pretty much the way the thinking goes. Why was Constantinople sacked at this time? Which, by the way, is all they ever did. They didn't wind up fighting against the Muslims this time. So the Fourth Crusade's really against the Eastern, formerly, the artists formerly known as the Eastern Empire. They were sacked. Well, here's why it happened. The Crusaders had had enough. The sack of the city has been treated as a particularly strange and barbarous kind of sack by modern liberal historians. They show themselves emotionally blind ideologues at that point. Given the circumstances, the sack may have been suicidal because it was counterproductive, but the kind of venom directed against it by self-hating Western historians in the decline of our own civilization is itself barbarous. Here's why it happened. It was an opportunity spawned by their very king, or at least their former king, Alexius, the son of Isaac II, who had just been deposed. So they had been the ones cutting treaties with the East, and he had been deposed, a guy named Alexius. So he was kind of hiding out in exile. So he meets together with these Western forces, and he makes a deal with them, a promise. If they would put him back on the throne in the East, he would grant them 10,000 Byzantine troops, he would submit the Eastern Church to the Latin Church, and he would form a permanent settlement of knights to guard the Holy Land. Not a bad deal. Everything you need to make this happen, and we will submit and form under your Western Empire. Not a bad deal for both sides. One of those deals that's too good to be true. And it was. Once back in the capital city, pressure mounted on Alexius as he had retaken the throne, and he turned sides. And when he was promptly murdered, the new emperor mounted an all-out war against the Western ships and occupiers. It didn't work, and a Western leader was placed on the throne, and he pretty much lasted for a meaningless 40 years. But that Fourth Crusade, that was all that was accomplished. The sacking and destruction of Constantinople once the bargain had gone back on. He'd gone back on that bargain. The Fifth Crusade, called by Pope Innocent III in 1213, changed its strategy to create a permanent settlement in Egypt. So now you're going to see the strategy change to Alexandria. Now, of course, they're going to be concerned about this, but who's fighting against them? These guys. So we've got to take out these guys, again, of Turkish origin. Now, it's true that Caliph Omar had originally brought his people over there, and that's who led it. And there had been two different caliphates vying for power since then. But this is pretty much a northern kind of Islam as opposed to the Arabian variety, at least in terms of ethnicity. Okay, so most of the Muslim resistance had come from there, and if some permanent solution was not achieved, the public sentiments for such crusades would be lost forever. So they had to do something now, and they had to do it along a different strategy. This would be the largest force yet sent on a crusade, which is surprising because it was mainly from smaller Central European kingdoms. And they would not set sail until 1218. The first siege had to be laid to the Nile Delta city of Damietta, so they couldn't get to Alexandria until they took over that delta of the Nile. The Muslims conceded and offered the entire kingdom of Jerusalem if the crusaders would only abandon Egypt. But the pig-headed overseer of the whole force, Cardinal, get this, I'm not making it up, Pelagius. Usually, when you, I don't know what a comparable example or analogy of that would be, but yeah, if somebody shows up and their name is Apollinarius, Nestorius, you know, one of these names that from the Valentinius of a former heretic, I mean, if some guy was running for office who was a Mormon, oh, what's happening? If somebody shows up and his name is actually Joseph Smith and he wants to lead the troops, you probably want to, you know, check some more. Anyway, they put a guy who wasn't, he didn't have any military experience. He's just a cardinal. But the Pope's thinking that he would represent our interests more once we settle. Cardinal Pelagius declined that offer. And being ignorant of the military realities, he allowed Muslim reinforcements time to bring aid in May of 1219. Amazingly, the crusaders still took the city, but ran it into disorder and drunkenness for the next year. So it happens when you have a bunch of Vikings do it. Anyway, it's okay to make fun of Vikings. They're not still around. Who are you going to offend, you know? So let's make fun of the Vikings. So the trading advantages back and forth. There's a new treaty that was proposed in 1221, except without the promised vacancy of the Holy Land. So it was a net loss. They got nothing but a couple of drunks set up in Alexandria. That's pretty much all they got out of it. Frederick II of Germany and Louis IX of France would launch their own national crusades. Frederick did it to reverse his excommunication in 1229, so notice the pious motivations. Louis to repay the Lord for healing him of what was considered to be a terminal illness in 1245. Though Louis did attempt to obtain the support of other monarchs, Frederick obtained a short-lived treaty with the Sultan of Egypt to reacquire the Crusader kingdom, and Louis's men faced humiliating capture and the choice of conversion or death. He himself was ransomed and returned home after strengthening the knights at Jerusalem. Louis returned in 1267 for another crusade, this time landing in Old Carthage and taking the route east. Problem was, plague showed up. So though he's... Sorry, this has already happened. But they're coming down this way now. But never happened. The plague hit him and his men. He died. And he was made a saint. In fact, Saint Louis. What did he do to become a saint? He didn't... I guess for his courage. I don't really remember, to tell you the truth. Yeah, he started the Rams football team. And, yeah. I have no idea what he did. Taxes and disillusionment were settling in. It's the end of the 13th century. People are probably thinking, this is the judgment of God. The few cities that were left under Western control were reconquered by Muslim armies at the turn of the 14th century. And so the map, which now may seem to you to be a confused jumble, at least there's a pushing out of Europe. But there's still Muslim inroads here. And so you have that Kalam school and they were called the Latin Averroists, and we'll talk about that next week. But they were still influential here, and they had a presence here, but it wasn't a military province of them anymore. But the map still looks like this now. So what did the Crusades actually accomplish on the map? Nothing. Absolutely nothing, except they did take these islands militarily. They did drive them out of Europe for the moment. But this is a classic case of the critics not being able to have it both ways. They will say that the West was hopelessly backward, both intellectually and morally. Let's think about that for a second, just on the face of it. Was the West hopelessly backward or not? If they were so backward, then how did they win such a prolonged conflict? Because as this moves from the 13th century to the 16th, and there's what are generally not recognized to be these crusades, but military might is still being exercised. Something happens to the map again once certain technological things show up, and that's part of the cynical argument. So let's fast forward a little bit here into the 15th and 16th century, just for a second, just a snapshot. If the West was so backward, how did they win such a prolonged conflict? Because eventually, once it was out of these guys' hands, they did win. Well, it will be said that they cheated by leaching gunpowder off of the Chinese. Cheating, by the way. But the wars lasted for 3 centuries. How exactly is that insufficient time for a superior civilization, such as Islam is said to be, to co-opt the same or invent it themselves? That's a pretty significant thing to do, to co-opt gunpowder, which, by the way, the Chinese were using it for fireworks. We twisted steel and said, hey, this could probably make a sizable hole in that guy's head. I'm going to use it for that. And they did. That's significant. Islam did not do that. That says something. But then the explanation will turn back to its roots in reasserting the basically peaceful disposition of the Muslim world in comparison to the bloodthirsty aspirations of Europe. But if that's true, then how do we explain the West's ceasefire once it had acquired means of war that made mere gunpowder look like children's firecrackers by comparison? In other words, once the West got things that could not only blow a hole in your head, but a hole in the earth about the size of Arabia, why didn't they? If it was moral inferiority. The falsity of this modern thesis is so clear that perhaps the only thing right about it is its self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, it represents the sort of self-hating effeminacy that has refused to confront the secular leadership of the Muslim world ever since, only because the West no longer has a reason for its own survival. And it is in that latter sense that the West is intellectually and morally inferior to Muslim civilization. There is one sense in which the West is inferior to Muslim civilization. Muslim civilization believes in Muslim civilization. Western civilization believes in nothing whatsoever and then proceeds to criticize everyone for standards that don't exist. Secularism is secular suicide. It cannot sustain its reason for being and will eventually bow the knee to the very thing it pretends to detest, a secular-minded religion, which is exactly why the secularists in the West bow the knee to the Muslims, as those fringe Christian groups did in that century. A bunch of people that don't want to live anymore and cannot wait for the first opportunity to fit their neck for a lampshade. Inventions of warfare were part of the technological explosion of this so-called Dark Ages. Here's the Dark Ages people, the barbarians, who can't even spell their own name, can't even walk straight. They're so drunk and bloodthirsty and all that good stuff that they invent. Let's see a couple of things they invented this time. Heavy cavalry was an innovation of the Franks, which they utilized to check the advance of the Moors in 732. This sturdy saddle and lances in the hands of its armored rider was crucial well into the era of the Crusades. And it worked. Even before gunpowder, it was effective and could have, by itself, destroyed them militarily had they had enough support going in that direction. The Muslims see this going on. Steel, spear, horses, let's do the same thing they never did. Why is that? Sometime between 1300 and 1310, as we mentioned briefly, an invention of the Chinese was disseminated through the European centers of powder, namely gunpowder. In China, as I said, it was mostly used for show, but in Europe it was channeled down the barrel of the first firearms. The first cannons were used in the West at an intramural battle at Metz in 1324. These explosives could now be taken to sea as well. So again, this is after these five rounds of crusades. And what's happening here is now not really to be called a crusade, but much like if somebody wanders onto your property and is threatening your wife and children, and you have a cannon and you can just... you ever see, what's the first Indiana Jones movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark? You remember when Harrison Ford, when Indiana Jones is going down the street and this guy busts out the machete, he's like, oh, no, 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 and everybody does, and he's like, oh, time for this. And he just shoots. That's my favorite part of the movie. Anyway, but effective. Clearly, the bullet is mightier than the sword in instances like that. And so that's why it's not really a crusade. It's more like the technology, the chickens had come home to roost. Western civilization was innovating and realized if these people are coming, we're going to repel them. They did, but not in a sustained way. But the technology was good enough. These explosives now could be taken to sea as well. The round ship was invented. And that could now take mass cargo and have multiple decks with multiple cannons in each deck, firing from each. The compass allowed the Western navies to know precise locations and outmaneuver the enemy. Arab ships, such as there were some, were stolen at first from Alexandrian ports, and then the more massive navies were constructed by European designs and often by European turncoats. So even what navies and technology the Arabs did have was again produced by Westerners. Technological progress was not merely a biblical expectation, but a Christian obligation. If someone must have advanced means of destruction, then it had better not be those who will use them for evil. The fact that such devices would inevitably be used for evil anyway is no good argument for good to sit by and watch or wish it away. You think of things like the unmanned attack helicopters and so on. That just reduces it to, like, that's unfair. You must be assuming that there's not people out there trying to kill your sister. I want unfair. I want quick kill with nobody up there to do it. Well, that'll just make it take away the gentlemanly war, like it's the same thing as putting AstroTurf in Wrigley Field. I think you're the sick weirdo. As if the point of war is to have a gentlemanly sparring. If you're doing war for any other reason than to wipe out somebody that needs to die, you shouldn't be in that war. You're the one that believes in unjust war if you're complaining about the unfairness of this AstroTurf. at this point. These were thinking men that thought like this. When people are thinking to the fullest, they do not emotionally hide behind their wishes and wish for a better world. They see the world for what it is and they make the best of it. And that means that men who know that they themselves are evil have no excuse to not oppose the violent manifestation of evil flowing out of others. Christians have known this in the past. The excusing of social evil under the guise of false humility is a very recent innovation of the church. There have always been cowards in the church, and often such cowards weasel their way to the top. But a theology of cowardice could find no permanent context in the Western civilization that the church built at this time. As the end of this era was happening, the Muslim navy was crushed by long-range cannon supremacy in 1571, the Battle of Lepanto. In order for the Turks aboard their ships to fire, they had to do the old-fashioned way and turn sideways. They had to turn sideways in their ships to fire at close range. And of course, when you do that, you make yourself a big, nice target for the more heavier cannons that are now firing from multiple decks. And it just so happens that the historic attitude toward the Crusades was also a Western invention. I already mentioned this in passing. A modern invention, that is. For centuries, their own writings, the Arab writings, bore witness to the relative indifference of modern Islam to these events. So, Stark says in his book, quote, most Arabs dismissed the Crusades as having been attacks upon the hated Turks, and therefore of little interest. Indeed, in the account written by Ibn Zafir at the end of the 12th century, it was said that it was better that the Franks occupy the kingdom of Jerusalem, as this prevented the spread of the influence of the Turks to the lands of Egypt, end quote. It was not until the 19th and 20th century that Western intellectuals began to disseminate the idea of the anti-Arab crusades into the Near Eastern world. What time is it? I know what time it is, but how long did I go there in the second session? Because that was the whole first session.
40 minutes.
Maybe I will do three sessions. That's what I'll do. Questions, and then a third section called the Difficult Defense of Reason.